McGill Daily of The Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from The McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit problematic.
News. Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT News collaboration. I'm your host, Chantel Schultz. Unfit to Print is a student-produced, bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. Today's episode will feature an interview with Palestinian poet and activist Rafif Ziadeh, who performed her album We Teach Life with Australian musician Phil Mansour in Montreal on September 26, 2016. Then we'll hear excerpts from the panel, Sexual Violence and Power Dynamics in a University Setting, which happened on September 29, 2016. The event was part of Consent Week at McGill. But first, headlines. On September 23, 2016, the first of three open forum meetings on sustainability was held for McGill community members to express their opinions on sustainability at the university. McGill Principal Suzanne Fortier was in attendance, as were members of student climate justice group Divest McGill. People expressed their disappointment with the report that the Committee to Advise on Matters of Social Responsibility, CAMSR, released in March 2016. The report found that the fossil fuel industry does not cause social injury. Students spoke about the impact of the fossil fuel industry on Indigenous peoples and on the importance of institutional accountability at McGill. Students also brought up ideas for new initiatives. This year, a McGill chapter of Independent Jewish Voices, IJV, was founded by McGill students Anna and Sonia. Their main goals, according to Anna, are to motivate critical Jewish students to gain awareness of the Israeli occupation and to bring awareness to the broader campus community. It is the first anti-Zionist Jewish group on campus since 2009. On September 29th, McGill's third annual Consent Week began with a vigil for missing and murdered Indigenous women. The event was organized by Consent McGill, the First People's House, and Indigenous students. It was held by the Oshawaga Rock on Lower Field, with about 60 people in attendance. Indigenous organizers spoke about how the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada is ignored by the Canadian government. The art of Monique Bedard, a Haudenosaunee artist with Métis and French-Canadian heritage, was displayed by the Oshawaga Rock. Indigenous community members spoke about the importance of continuing vigils and remembering these missing and murdered women. For more in-depth coverage of these stories, and for other McGill and Montreal news, pick up a copy of the McGill Daily on stands now, or visit our website at mcgilldaily.com/news. We'll now hear an interview with Rafif Ziadeh, a Palestinian poet and activist who performed with Australian musician Phil Mansour at La Vitrola on September 26, 2016. First, we'll listen to an excerpt of her poem, Shades of Anger.
حاليا اتكلم بلساني العربي قبل ان يحتلوا لغتي ايضا. Allow me to speak my Arab tongue before they occupy my language as well. Allow me to speak my mother tongue so her words can come through me before they colonize her memory as well. I am an Arab woman of color and we come in all shades of anger. All my grandfather ever wanted to do was wake up at dawn and watch my grandmother kneel and pray in a village hidden between Yaffa and Haifa.
You just heard an excerpt of Rafif Ziadeh's poem, Shades of Anger. In the following interview, Ziadeh talks about Israeli settler colonialism, the importance of poetry in political struggles and activism, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS movement, and her involvement with the BDS National Committee, or the BNC. What do you think the importance of poetry is to the political struggle in Palestine?
I think in general, poetry and art help to sustain us as human beings. A lot of times in political organizing, we forget that we're in this for the long term, and we need to, for lack of a better word, like, keep our souls nourished. And I think poetry and art more generally help to really clarify what the struggle is about and why we're doing this, that it's actually about hope and dignity and justice, and not just about the injustices that we face. It articulates the different kind of world that we want to see. In the Palestinian case in particular, we are facing the Israeli state, which says that we don't have a culture, that we don't exist. So cultural production, being able to write and speak about Palestine, becomes in itself an act of resistance and asserting that we have rights and that we are an indigenous people and we have a culture that deserves to be valued.
You recited Fadwa Tuqan's poetry tonight and spoke about the importance of Palestinian women poets and how when people speak about Palestinian poetry, they're usually speaking about men. Mm-hmm. So who are some Palestinian women poets who have inspired you?
Certainly Fadwa Tuqan has been a huge inspiration for me. The writings of May Ziadeh, who was a Palestinian feminist writer, have been extremely inspirational. I think in the younger generations, Suhair Hamad helped to really open doors for a lot of Arab and Palestinian women, especially ones who live in North America, to... she was an inspiration in seeing someone like her be on the stage. And I think it's a bit tricky with Palestine because we're also a diasporic people. So what language we perform in makes a difference. There's Arabic poetry, there's English poetry, and it has that sense of exile. And I've sort of eclectically chosen from all of these different inspirations.
How do you organize? So you say you're an activist. How do you organize outside of your poetry?
I'm very involved in the campaign for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. I work with the Palestinian National Committee and also on the campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. Those are my main avenues of organizing. For a very long time, I used to be a student organizer, and in that capacity, I worked on Israeli Apartheid Week for a long number of years. So I'd say my main involvement is through BDS campaigning.
What would you say is the importance of academic and cultural boycotts?
I think Israel projects itself in the world as a country that has a lot of academic output and cultural output, and that's how it wants to be normal and known on the world stage. If you look at apartheid in South Africa, what they were known for were their sports and the wine. I would say Israel doesn't have great wine and doesn't have the greatest sports. So focusing on the way it projects itself in the world through art and culture is really important. And quite often people will say, oh, but these things aren't political. But if you look at a settler colonial context, these issues are really political. The Israeli Academy has produces the architects of the apartheid wall. It produces a lot of the military equipment that is used in the occupation. And hardly anyone in the Israeli military speaks out against the occupation of Palestine or for Palestinian rights in full. So we are for... the ending the complicity of these institutions in the system of oppression that Palestinians face. And it's very important to highlight the different ways Israeli institutions are complicit.
With the BNC, what sorts of things are you focusing on right now?
One of the campaigns I've been very involved in is the campaign to stop G4S. G4S is one of the world's largest private military and security companies. It is involved... it is complicit in Israel's occupation of Palestine. It provides equipment to Israeli prisons where Palestinian political prisoners are being held. Also equipment to checkpoints that Palestinians have to struggle through every day. And it provides equipment to Israel's illegal settlements. It is also a company very involved in massive privatization of state assets. It basically takes over state duties and has been involved in the detention of asylum seekers, some of whom have been killed under G4S watch. So targeting this corporation is extremely important, in my view, because of their complicity in Palestine, but also because of what the corporation stands for in general. It is a corporation that supposedly is meant to provide security. In essence, it's only security for the rich, security for the banks, and not security for people. And I think it really highlights how corporations make money off of people suffering and make money off of occupations like the illegal occupation of Palestine. So G4S campaign is one of the ones I've been involved in. The military embargo on Israel is another one that I participate in as much as I can, because Israel is one of the most militarized states in the world. And not only do they practice their weapons on Palestinians, they then market these weapons around the world, saying that they are battle-tested or field-tested, meaning they're tested on the bodies of Palestinians, and then they're marketed all around the world. To me, this is a huge danger, not just against the Palestinian people, but that these forms of repression are being exported around the world. So to me, the Stop G4S campaign and the military embargo have been some of the highlights that I've worked on.
And what would you say to people who want to help organize for the liberation of Palestine?
I mean, I would say that what's happening in Palestine is not a humanitarian catastrophe. It is a very politically planned settler colonial project of ethnically cleansing the indigenous population of Palestine off of our land. That what we need is not charity from everyone. What we need is solidarity, and for people to end their own complicity with the system of oppression. People living in Canada, the Canadian government is extremely supportive of Israel, diplomatically, militarily, economically. There are open relations, and they're very proud of them. These kinds of open relations mean that every Canadian citizen becomes complicit in what Israel is actually doing. Canadian corporations are complicit in what Israel is doing. Our pension funds are invested in corporations that actually help to harm the Palestinian people. So the BDS call in general is about people looking at the different ways in which they are complicit, in which their governments are complicit, and making a change, ending that kind of support, similarly to what we have done in the past with apartheid in South Africa. And I think people were able to really make an impact and change the situation there by putting their governments and holding their on the spot and holding their governments to account. And I think the same can be done with Israel again.
Lastly, can you talk a bit about your current project and tour?
So we just launched this CD called We Teach Life earlier this year. It's been a long-term project because the poem We Teach Life was filmed and put on YouTube, and I didn't even actually know it was being filmed, and it went viral, but it was never recorded. So this CD, this album, is a collection of poems from We Teach Life moving onwards. My last CD was called Hadil, so this is the second one. And essentially, it's the narration of what happened since Hadil was produced, the ongoing siege on Gaza, the different assaults on Gaza, my own story with immigration and borders, all put to poetry and music. It's with the Australian musician Phil Mansour. We collaborated on the music, and I hope we've produced something that is strong and inspires people to do something.
You just heard an interview with Rafif Ziadeh, a Palestinian performance poet and activist who is touring and performing her new album, We Teach Life, with Phil Mansour. Jude Hashman, a first-year McGill student from Jordan, attended the event and spoke about her experience listening to Ziadeh's performance.
So I was a huge fan of her before. There were a lot of videos like that went viral for her, like for her poem We Teach Life, Sir, and Shades of Anger. And those were poems that like specifically resonated with me because, I mean, of like the climate in the area I'm living in. And I used to go to an all-girls school where, like, my instructors were very, like stubborn about, like, planting this passion for, like, you know, like, the arts and, like, the struggle and their, like, resistance. So seeing her live was, like, it was something unreal. I don't know, like, it gave me a lot of goosebumps. It gave me, like, I felt like I was just, like, trying to film everything for, like, my classmates or whatever. So, yeah, it was great.
Next, you'll hear excerpts from the panel called Sexual Violence and Power Dynamics in a University Setting. The panel was held on September 29th, 2016, and was a part of Consent Week, which is organized by Consent McGill. Student Society for McGill University, SMU Equity, and the Social Equity and Diversity Education, SEED, Community Engagement Day also collaborated on the event. One speaker on the panel was Nina Hermes, a fourth-year social work student and floor fellow who's been involved with the Sexual Assault Center of the McGill Student Society, SACOMS, and the Sexual Assault Policy Working Group. The student-led working group worked on a draft of a sexual assault policy over 3 years, which the administration ultimately withdrew its support for earlier this year. The administration has now proposed its own draft for the sexual violence policy. Another speaker was Claire Michaela, the president of the Association of McGill University Support Employees, AMUSE, which represents about 1,500 casual employees at McGill. Michaela previously worked as an academic advisor at the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies. She followed the Sexual Assault Policy Working Group over the last couple of years and has been working on the redrafting of the new sexual violence policy, as AMUSE and other labor unions have been consulting on the process. Also on the panel was Jason Opel, an associate professor in the Department of History, who became involved with speaking out against sexual assault at McGill in recent years after learning about professor-student relationships. The final panelist was Adrian Piggott, who has been the chair of the Subcommittee for Racialized and Ethnic Persons for 5 years and a harassment assessor at McGill for 2. Piggott has advised on the current draft for the sexual violence policy. The panel was moderated by Angela Yu, the Equity and Diversity Commissioner of the Postgraduate Student Society, PGSS. Yu was also a part of the previous Sexual Assault Policy Working Group, as well as currently on the Sexual Violence Policy and Protocol Working Group. First, we'll hear some opening remarks from the panelists. Piggott spoke about the importance of intersectionality when evaluating power dynamics in sexual assault.
When it comes to the power dynamics and sexual violence within a university, especially being chair of the Racialized and Ethnic Persons Subcommittee, this is a multi-tiered thing for us because the racialized and ethnic community of McGill is already fairly marginalized. Very few racialized people in faculty, in staff, in the higher echelons of the university. So a group that has very little representation and is not necessarily well served by the mental health support services of McGill or any of the other support services of McGill. It makes it extremely difficult to feel comfortable and safe disclosing when you are experiencing this kind of violence. It's already traumatic, and then on top of that, you are in a community that does not necessarily feel welcoming. So in that regard, I think there's an added layer of difficulty in dealing with sexual violence for people who are from underrepresented groups, whether it's because you're queer or racialized or disabled or any of the number of other factors that lead to you being not part of the majority of the McGill community. We are working towards improving that through policy changes, and obviously I've been called upon by the group working on the sexual assault policy to provide some of that insight into the intersectionality so that you can understand how we can address not just survivor support for everyone, but also survivor support that understands that it's not one size fits all.
Michaela spoke about sexual assault and harassment in the context of the workplace and AMUSE.
Before a resolution is found in these cases, dealing with harassment in the workplace is one of the most disempowering experiences that an employee can have. Harassment can come from either a manager or a peer. In either case, employees may dread coming to work, but they can't simply leave. Finding a job is not easy these days, and it can be impossible for an employee to leave a job without having another one secured. A lot of AMUSE members in particular have jobs through work study, which is based on financial need. So there's already an inherent power relationship between the employee and the employer that puts workers at a disadvantage. Furthermore, casual employees are often students. This means that their manager might be their professor or their sports coach in addition to being their boss. So there's often more than one way in which the work we do on the clock limits our ability to speak out against injustices. Casual employees have an additional barrier to bringing up work issues that most other employees don't face, which is their short-term contract. Casual employees must be on their best behavior or they can easily be let go without actually being fired. The employer simply has to wait until their contract is up and not renew it. For all of the reasons that I've listed, you can imagine that it would be very difficult for someone to come forward with an issue of sexual violence. The point of being in a union is to be stronger together, to have common knowledge and experiences that an individual can tap into and garner support from. We can do that as a community here in this room, even if we are non-unionized. We can fight for a better policy that devotes resources to survivors of sexual assault. We can demand that there be procedures in place that are known to the McGill community when sexual violence is brought forward and those procedures are enacted properly. We can start by talking to our representatives at the University Senate and making sure that a subpar policy is not passed there. Of course, we can continue to share information with each other and learn from each other as we're doing now, and we can educate ourselves by reading about survivors' experiences published in the Daily and elsewhere. I leave you with this: we're stronger together.
Opal described how he first became aware of the issue of sexual assault in universities when he was a student, and two of his friends were sexually assaulted over his university career. He had two suggestions for how professors can be helpful to survivors of sexual assault, rather than be a part of the problem.
The first is that professors, or at least some professors, need to be informed and visible allies. Those two adjectives are very important. It can't just be allies in some passive sense. They have to be informed and visible. By informed, I mean they have to have at least some basic training, understanding, experience with what you do, what one says, how one immediately reacts to someone who comes forward and confides in you that they've been a victim of sexual violence or sexual harassment, and not just sort of pull back and be scared and say, I can't deal with this, this is not my job. That can't happen, because what that actually does is reinforce all the various barriers that move up around victims.
Opal suggested professors can have a sign on their office door indicating it is a safe space for people who have experienced sexual assault or violence to speak to a sympathetic voice. He said these signs could visibly disrupt a landscape of hostility for students. Opal's second suggestion was for professors to be role models, not to feel that they are in charge of their students, but rather to be models of self-respect and respect to their students.
Obviously or not obviously, this means that in no cases ever should professors ever flirt with or treat their students like sexual objects. I can tell you later, if you wish, all kinds of accounts of sort of what happens when this occurs, and the immediate sort of barriers that form around the professor, because we can't have any rumors floating around. We can't have the faculty disrupted by rumors to disrupt the faculty's harmony. And again, it's always isolating the person who's actually been wronged. So I'd like to talk that through a bit, think about ways we can disrupt that pattern.
Hermes spoke about how she was sexually assaulted in her first year at McGill while living in residence by her floor fellow with whom she had had a close relationship. Hermes said that the man who assaulted her was quietly let go and that she was not involved in the process and did not know until the day he had left.
I felt as someone, you know, as who just survived this trauma, you know, I really felt like it was swept under the rug and that they really just wanted to quietly usher this guy out the end of finals so that no one had any idea what happened. Recently, I've just started to be very open about this experience because I think if we don't talk about it, it's going to keep happening. And it's the same thing with, you know, flirting or thinking about any of these sort of bad boundaries that are drawn.
Hermes also spoke about how people must be aware of the power they have in certain situations.
Yeah, like that I think it really still needs to be kind of driven home for folks more that when you're given these positions of power, even, you know, if it's small positions of power, it's like you, the onus is on you, not the person you're in a position of power over. It's like so often there's this blame that gets put on this person. It's like they can do whatever the hell they want. Like it's on you to set those boundaries and to use that power for good, essentially.
Piggott spoke about the current systems at McGill for people reporting sexual assault.
We don't have a really good system for addressing those situations, those cases on campus, because so many of our policies require the complainant to be named, require that kind of confrontational approach, so there's no way to protect the complainant from the person that they need to file the complaint against.
You asked the panelists what they thought of talking and hearing about sexual assault through informal channels. Hermes speculated on why it is so common.
I think one of the reasons that we're hearing, I mean, this is just me speculating, but I think one of the reasons that we hear about that so much in through informal channels is that those are one of the few avenues that survivors can access. You know, it's like these institutional channels are completely blocked off. So, I mean, for me, I mean, it was like Facebook statuses, like articles, like this is the only way I feel like I can actually share these things and that I have access to. But unfortunately, like, rarely does that result in any sort of justice. I can write as many articles as I want, but that's not going to get someone out of their tenured position.
A graduate student asked the panelists what they thought about the administration's draft of the sexual violence policy. Hermes responded that she was disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, it's my opinion that, I mean, the draft that McGill released sounds a lot like a nice thing to cover their ass while still looking like they have a policy. It's very, very vague. There's not a lot in there. I mean, everything kind of just refers to other policies that the university already has that we've seen don't work, that we've heard from people aren't working. And, you know, I wasn't surprised when the draft was released. Honestly, I kind of expected it from McGill.
Michaela spoke about her experience in meetings consulting on the sexual violence policy and the importance of having a procedure.
I was consulted as a stakeholder on campus. And I was told, which surprised me, I was told in those meetings about the policy that a procedure is not to be included in a policy. That a policy is about more about intentions or frameworks, but it doesn't include a procedure. So that's why I've been stressing demanding a procedure so much, because I think that that can be as important, if not more important, for survivors of sexual violence, because you need to know what the university is committing to for you. And I agree a lot with a lot of what Nina is saying, because I don't think that the university is promising to do anything other than what it's already been doing, which is not really good enough.
Piggott spoke to the emphasis on survivors in the new policy. The draft of the policy has been criticized by students for not addressing perpetrators or bystanders enough, if at all.
Part of what we were attempting to achieve is ensuring the safety and facilitating the recovery of the survivor. Because you can't insist that someone go to the police. You can't, you know, you can't direct someone to seek legal recourse if that's not what they want to do or feel empowered or prepared to do. But what we can do is put the right support systems in place for those people who want to stay within the university community.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of what the policy was striving for.
Hermes explained the resistance she's come up against when speaking about her experience of sexual assault.
Ever since I started sharing about this experience, I've just kind of gotten this feeling that, like, the residents community didn't really want me to share about it. Like, it was never outrightly said, but just, there's always that feeling of, like, they want to kind of sweep it under the rug. I mean, there's this issue with the floor fellow role. I mean, we've, you know, we're part of a muse. Like, we've unionized a few years ago because we're not paid legally and lots of other things that I could speak for an hour on. But, you know, there's a big problem with institutional memory there in, you know, the things that happen year to year. And if there are abuses of power, it's not passed on. And it's not encouraged to be passed on either. And that, for me, is a very concerning mentality.
Hermes then talked about what people can do in fighting sexual assault and supporting survivors.
Personally, I believe, you know, the unfortunate situation is that, you know, these situations when sexual violence, harassment, assault occur, the onus often falls on the survivor or the person affected to, like, do the labor in, like, you know, seeking out recourses if they want or doing this or finding support. And often the either friends of the perpetrator, friends of the survivor kind of feel like, oh, well, I don't really have a part to play in this. And I'm a big, big, big believer in, especially friends of, like, perpetrators, like, you know, bros keeping bros accountable, essentially. Like, you know, I mean, people other than men can absolutely sexually assault, but, you know, it's, I watched this happen in residences before, and, you know, out in the world, of, like, guys knowing that their friends did, like, a weird thing happened with somebody, and then no one says anything, and then it keeps happening. You know, I think even just by having a conversation with someone of, like, hey, that thing you did the other weekend was really messed up, and, like, you need to acknowledge that. You know, I think small individual level things like that are like a very concrete way that people can kind of start to make that change. I mean, there's obviously, you know, it's everything here is an issue of, is a symptom of a larger systemic issue. But I think on that individual level, recognizing that we're all accountable is a very small piece in that larger puzzle. I think real support is action. You know, absolutely, you know, the base level, believe someone. I mean, you know, at a bare minimum. But there also needs to be action with that. You know, that looks like actually sitting down with the perpetrator and having a conversation with them. Like, making sure that they understand why what they did was wrong. Because I can tell you, the worst thing is hearing from the person that assaulted you that they don't even think they assaulted you. You know? Like, at a bare minimum, help this perpetrator understand what they did wrong. You know, that for me is like that's the best way you can show support to survivors.
Lastly, Pigott spoke about how she met with some of the chairs of the other 5 equity subcommittees on campus and what they will propose this year.
What we're going to propose is mandatory equity training for everyone, essentially, which would include a portion on sexual assault, sexual harassment, and it would also include harassment and discrimination, but it would have a portion on that as well. It's what we're going to propose this year as a policy change. And it would sort of be the same way students have to do the academic integrity course. They would have to do this kind of training as well. And then we would extend that to faculty and staff as well.
You just heard excerpts from the panel, Sexual Violence and Power Dynamics in a University Setting, which was part of Consent Week at McGill. That's all for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Make sure to tune in 2 weeks to hear our next episode, and in the meantime, check out our previous coverage and podcasts at mcgilldaily.com/podcast or pick up a print copy on stands now.
Unfit to Print.